December 26, 2001, it's a Watt from Pedro show. Watt from Pedro Show, December 26, 2001. That was Sonic Youth Lydia Lunch. My special guest, come all the way to Pedro, Mr. Thurston Moore.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here in San Pedro.
You're talking
once
all
again.
Little, huh?
I'm sorry. I haven't been here since, God, 3 years ago, maybe? Two, 3 years ago, I came here, visited Mike. We went out, had some fish tacos.
You're going to go after the show today,
went
right?
To the secondhand bookstore. It's closed.
Yeah.
I was supposed to be here last week, but I was busy.
Not last week. A couple
well,
days
I'm
ago.
Talking, I'm talking like a couple of days ago. I was supposed to be on the show.
You didn't know what day of the week it was.
I was supposed to be on the show. I didn't know what the day of the week. It's Christmas time. I thought Christmas was on a Wednesday, and
yeah.
It was Monday, and I thought it was a Sunday, and I was supposed to be here on a Monday, and Mike called me up on the phone. He said, like, where are you? I'm at the station doing the show. I said, I'm in Simi Valley.
Not station, but the Love Grotto.
Exactly, the Love Grotto.
San Pedro, right, Brother
it's like
Matt?
A station
yeah,
to me. It's like a station of the cross here for me, though.
Oh.
This is a beautiful studio for me. This is like, this is San Pedro come to life.
All the comforts of home.
Yeah, this is right. You don't see this anywhere else in America except for here in San
Pedro.
Wait,
can you tell me about that song?
Death Valley 69?
Yeah.
That was written in, I guess, in 88, 87, 88, maybe earlier. Whenever that record came out, you know.
You had
like
Henry's tattoo
history.
On the label.
That's right.
It's
well,
a Shepherd thing, right?
You know, Henry had joined Black Flag, and so Henry was like sort of really getting into this kind of L.A. thing through like Black Flag and Raymond's, you know, work and stuff, and this whole kind of world of underground L.A., of, you know, the hippie culture that existed, but the underbelly of the hippie culture that was kind of like this recent past, that was like kind of this dark America that was like kind of interesting, that was not being really sort of related in the media, because at the time, you have to understand, we had Reagan as president. And the whole thing was like, we're going to go back to the past, you know, the beauty of the past and the safety of the past, and we're going to try to bring up these ideals of the past. And we were like, well, you know, there was a whole world happening in the past that was going on, where there's a lot of sort of very sort of insane insurgency going on in the youth culture that people don't really sort of aren't really talking about now. And you'd see it in Raymond's work a lot. You'd hear it a little bit in Flag. I know Henry was sort of investigating it. So Henry started.
He was into Nick Cave, too.
He's getting into Nick Cave, but he's also getting into sort of like Manson lore and stuff like that. So
I think that was too
I think out. At the same time, we were kind of getting interested, and we started reading. We were trying to read sort of history that wasn't really being made available to us, and so we started picking up reading about things like the family and reading these books on sort of this hippie subculture. And one thing we wanted to write about was this sort of like this kind of this whole the whole sort of Manson thing of Death Valley, and when they were like sort of creating their own world outside, but it was like this insane world, obviously, with this kind of like little Hitler guy. But we wanted to write about it. We didn't want to write about it too literally, and I just sort of mentioned it to Lydia Lunch, who I was sort of playing music with at the time, and she was getting really interested in what
that album.
She was getting interested in what people like Black Flag were doing. And you got to understand, like at that time on the East Coast, nobody was really paying attention to what people like, you know, Raymond and Black Flag and SST Records, and even like people like Red Cross and people like Joe Carducci, who was working there and espousing these kind of ideas. People on the East Coast weren't really aware of it so much. You know, the network of communication wasn't really there. The only thing we had was the fact that Flag would come through town, you know, playing at the local donut shop or something, and then they would
Great Gildersleeves.
So in a way, we felt really
Brooklyn
sort of
Zoo.
We were really inspired by
Remember
it.
Remember that disco, the
Brooklyn Zoo?
Zoo?
And Kim sort of came from out here. And
sort of.
Well, you never know about these things. Anyway, to make a long story short, because it is a long story, and I'm not really sort of elucidating on it very well, but we just wrote this song. And Lydia wrote, I wrote the chorus, you know, and Lydia wrote the verse. And we had this riff that we were playing in the studio, because, you know, we were playing all this weird kind of experimental non-music, because we were like non-musicians. We didn't know how to play really well. Actually, Lee knew how to play.
Came out of the Bronco.
Lee knew how to play.
We were playing some theoretical.
Well, we knew how to play, but we didn't know how to play like technical, standard, you know, real. Professional.
And Lee knew the Dead.
Lee knew how to play stuff, but me and Kim and
this is
Bob
pre-Shelley.
Bird, pre-Shelley, pre-Steve Shelley. So somehow on one of these guitars that was really tuned to all these F sharps, I started playing this one riff that was very sort of had a very rock vibe, and to us that was like a big deal because we just stumbled upon sort of some rock riff. And we're like, whoa, hey, we're rocking in a way that's like almost real rock, not this kind of weird sonic rock. And so we joked around with it, and so we made a song out of it, and it became the song that everybody kind of like really responded to. It's like, oh yeah, they're playing this like heavy rock vibe. And so we never really took Death Valley 69 as seriously, but it did become kind of a cornerstone of that period for us in a way. That
you put it on a record too, where it
first came out on a 7-inch.
Right, Mike Shepherd.
Who was this kid here. I was sending music around to different people, and I had heard about Iridescence, which was Mike Shepherd's label, because he had done some stuff with Half Japanese. And I just sort of sent it to him, and he called up immediately and said, like, oh, yeah, I'll put these two songs out. That one, and there's another song called Brave Men Run.
That's right, My Family.
Yeah, which was the lyrics that Kim wrote, taken from a Ed Ruscha painting of a sailor, a big sailing vessel on the ocean. And it's a painting of a sailing vessel on the ocean, and on top of it were the words, Brave Men Run in My Family. It's a beautiful painting by Ed Ruscha, West Coast artist. And Kim really loved this artist, and we had this poster, and she wrote these words inspired by this painting.
It's on that record too. I think it's after on a Creedence song. It's a Homestead thing. There's a head guy on fire.
That's Bad Moon Rising.
Yeah, but there's no Creedence song on there. Just
no, because we were all, the whole thing of that period was just like kind of like an investigation of kind of underground Americana, and that a lot of it that was lost on the punk rock community because we had sort of shut the door so much on 77. You know, 76, 77 was just like burn the past, create this new thing. And I think it was in the 80s at the time that we started, it was kind of a radical gesture to actually investigate beyond and before 77. And certainly we saw SST doing that, of bringing in sort of earlier kind of heavy metal ideas. But growing your hair was like a radical gesture at that time.
Beards.
Because that was really hardcore at the time when Flag started doing that.
Yeah.
Like, sort of like
because things were getting ossified and kind of orthodox.
Exactly. And
with hardcore. Not saying hardcore was really bad and everything, but it did bring some problems.
But even in the 70s, like in 77, I was talking to Ray Farrell about this. It's like people don't understand, like, one of the most intense things for him was walking in the CBGB in 76 and seeing Television on stage and just being completely blown away by this group that had short hair. Because there was probably not one group.
John McLaughlin.
Yeah, but that didn't count. I mean, like a four-piece rock band on stage, in middle New York with short hair and playing this weird music was very, very odd at the time.
I remember getting the Marquee Moon record. Came out in 76,
right.
I graduated high school. And the picture, there's guys sitting next to Little Friend Durant. I had never seen anything like that.
Yeah.
And no effects on the guitars when you listen to the music. It was intense.
It was good.
Yeah.
But
it was a mind blow. It was iconoclastic because of all, this was the era of Pete Frampton and a bathrobe.
It's Pete Frampton in the bathroom. You can never get your hair to look like that. You could never get your hair looking good. We're all like ugly, dorky jerkos. And so to see like these like people like Hell who look like you in a way, but he was like looking good because he was like, torn up
and then singing.
He looked the way he sang and stuff.
That's true.
It was excellent.
It was a mind blow for me.
Now even Patty, who's sort of like this kind of untrained kind of like thing, and it was like coming across all black and white, and he's like, not subscribing to this.
I stumbled onto her weird because she was with Alan Lanier, who played guitar.
Yeah, it was a Blue Oyster Cult. There was all this little sort of transitional stuff.
I saw the record Horses.
Yeah.
And then I saw that Piss Factory and it said Tom Verlaine, and it was weird how these were connected.
Little connectos.
Living in Pedro and just arena rock, I didn't know any of that culture.
Yeah.
Now, you were in New York City yet? Or still in Connecticut?
I moved there early 77 as an 18-year-old. I had been going there. I had gone there in 76. I started taking my father's Volkswagen because I had one friend in high school who knew about Cream magazine, and we used to sort of like That's what look at, and people used to make fun of us because there's pictures of like Todd Rundgren in there, and they're like, oh, you know, that guy's gay, and Bowie's gay, and who's this Iggy guy? He must be gay.
Rocky.
And so it was all this gay, you know, we're just like, well, you know, I guess we like all this gay music, you know. And so I was like, well, what the hell, you know, and it's like, and then we knew that it was nearby. We knew it was in New York City somehow. We knew the Ramones were there. We kept seeing little pictures of them, and they were out. And when their record came out, it was just like, that thing looked great. You know, those guys look amazing. But we knew that nobody else liked it. They were still into Almonds and Yes. And and so I think one day after school, we just sort of like said, hey, let's just go to New York and go see one of these bands. And we were, you know, we were teenagers. We were like 16, 17. We just went. No itinerary, just went, cruised around. We had an address for Max's, and we found it, and we parked, and we were there like about 6 in the evening. You know, nothing gets started until midnight.
Yeah.
We just drinking Cokes, smoking cigarettes. Finally, we went upstairs, and it was like an amazing show. It was like Suicide.
Oh,
can you imagine
wow.
seeing Suicide when you don't know what you're expecting? I thought it was going to be a heavy metal band.
Marina Rock.
I thought it was going to be some metal rock. You're like, Suicide. They like came out.
Alan, did he attack the crowd?
Alan Vega attacked the crowd, came walking out on the tables, breaking people's glasses and cutting himself, and then, like, wrapping his mic cord around, like, women's heads and screaming at them. And, like, and then he would yell at the audience, like, get out! Leave! I never knew anything. Like, you're not supposed to say that to an audience. Tell them to leave. They were psychotic and super loud, just, like, pummeling.
With one guy,
Yeah, Rev.
Martin Rev.
He just stood there with, like, in front of this little keyboard set up with big bug-eye shades just staring at the audience, just moving his fingers. And Vega would be had old lady's wig on, like, little fake scars on his face, but we thought they were real. Like he'd be on his knees singing, like, Cherie Cherie.
Yeah.
Actually crying with tears coming down his face.
Wow.
Because he was, like, so into it.
There's some
it
heavy
theater.
Songs.
It was all theater, but we were, like, freak. We were
Frank
scared.
Frankie Teardrop?
Yeah.
Very heavy song.
That they did that whole first record in front of us, and we were just, and they were like the last band on. Before them was the Cramps.
Oh,
wow.
Man.
And it was like, and it was like, and it was like, it was the first Cramps gig at Max's, and everybody like made fun of them. They came out, and it was like, we're the Cramps. And they had Miriam Linna playing drums. She sort of hit the rims more than the skins kind of thing. And people just are laughing at them. Like, hey, drum solo. You know, that kind of stuff. Like, nobody responded to them except for they were kind of funny. But they were, like, total, yeah, weird garage rockabilly thing.
Yeah.
And the best thing about it is, like, when they ended...
Brian Gregory,
like, spitting cigarettes out at the audience while he's playing. They were great, man. And then, like, at the end, the coolest thing was Miriam Linna got up, got her drumsticks, and put them in her pocketbook. And then walked off stage. I had never seen that before. I had never seen bands before. I had seen a couple of arena rock gigs like Zappa and Frampton and Jay Giles. I had never seen nothing like that. I was sold. So we went back every week. Every week we went there, man. We saw everything.
The journey.
Sort of like it was good. Anyway, I remember Lydia Lunch when she was just a kid hanging out at the same clubs. She was a dark, dark force.
She had teenage Jesus.
Well, that was later. That was like 70. I moved there in 77, started playing with some band, and then there was like this whole internalized scene of people like my age who had moved there. Like most people from art school, less people like me who just came out of like, you know, the burbs or some rural area. But these were people who came there for some kind of motivation because they were coming out of art school and they wanted to go to New York because that's where artists work, but they were drawn by the energy of the punk rock scene.
Yeah.
And then the punk rock scene, Talking Heads, Patty, Television, they were kind of dispersing a little bit and going off. Patty, you know, was getting married and moving to Detroit. You know, Television was floundering. Major label woes for these bands. And so all these, like, new young bands started, like, you know, they were just like, well, we're not even interested in what these bands, you know, they were calling these original bands hippies in a way because
like
they were
Adrenaline OD.
No, that was hardcore.
Yeah.
I'm talking about like Teenage Jesus and the Jerks,
the
Contortion,
No
Wave bands.
I got that record. No New York. We made one in response. Yes, L.A.
Yes, L.A. But that was like rock, the punk rock bands. These were bands that just stripped any kind of sense of rhythm and blues out of
James,
the music. These were real people.
Except
who
James Chance, he had some rhythm and blues.
Yeah, he was really into like James Brown.
Yeah.
But
he played in at the second mask and attacked people.
But these were a lot of people who are coming out of like visual arts wanting to sort of like really make a whole mesh of like what they were doing into music and just creating this whole form. And it was everywhere. That's how it was in SF too. I mean, it was all sort of visual artists doing this thing, and you know, LA, it was a lot of art school kind of like
people in
people.
I know the weirdos were,
and that's what
we're gonna play some
in a way. That's what the punk rock thing was,
a lot of art people at first.
Yeah.
And then that rock and roll of Johnny Thunder.
So when hardcore started up, and it was funny, in the 80s, all the
Cro-Mag.
You know, we'd be playing, and it would be always things like, we were an artsy band. And so the hardcore kids were like, oh, artsy band. And I was like, yeah, but that's sort of, that was punk rock, you know. But then it wasn't anymore. It was like this purist kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we were all embarrassed with all our guitars and screwdrivers and drumsticks and experimental stuff. But then, you know, it changed. It came back. It's like the more creative and kind of experimental you are now, the more it's a hip cachet to it. And that didn't exist so much in the 80s so much. It was always looked upon as an anomaly or something. You know, buttholes and,
sure,
you know, we were kind of this weird thing. But now it's not like that. It sort of came full circle.
Yeah.
So you have all these young people now who are really into like finding out about experimental music, even if it's through like DJ culture.
Right. You know, you're going to play some Noi later, and that's what, early 70s?
That's early 70s. I mean, that was like...
So if you hang
there's
out
lot,
long enough,
there's a lot
it's
going to
come back around.
Punk.
That's the lesson, right? Just hang out long. We started with John Coltrane. Welcome. What about John Coltrane and that stuff when you were a kid?
I didn't really listen to any American jazz music as a kid. I wasn't aware of it. It wasn't really in my household. My father was more sort of classical music centric, and so I didn't know about jazz. I just sort of knew it existed. I knew that when I got into television... bands like that, I knew that they sort of referenced Albert Eiler, and I knew, even like you mentioned James Chance, I knew that he referenced Albert Eiler, and he would reference even things like Ornette Coleman or John Coltrane, and I knew about Sun Ra, and I knew these were people who were very sort of avant-garde musicians, but I didn't really know what their history was in the lineage of jazz. And it wasn't until I knew that it was being referenced a lot by a lot of West Coast punk rock scenes, specifically the ones you were in, like the Minutemen and Flag and the SST thing, there was a certain sort of there was a certain reference to sort of avant-garde jazz going on there. So early, mid-80s, I got really sort of curious about it. I knew Kim grew up in a household where her father played John Coltrane records. When I would play that stuff out of interest, it would really confound me, because these were sort of expanded pieces of music. And I had not had that kind of language in my life, where it was like the expanded pieces of music. It was all very sort of like the song.
Yeah.
The song composition.
I never heard that stuff as a kid either.
Yeah.
Maybe housing.
So I had Byron Coley, who I guess he used to work with you guys at SST a little bit.
Yeah.
And he had a complete aficionado's vantage point of avant-garde jazz. And we were going out on...
grew up with it.
Yeah, and we were going out on tour in 87 or so, some six-month tour that Chuck Dukowski
Evil
set up.
Or
and, so I said, I asked him to make me some tapes, and he made me like 20 tapes of his music.
Oh,
historically,
wow.
I mean, it was like Mingus was on there, and I crash coursed in the whole way, and I just like listened to it all, and it finally sort of became something I really got interested in. And then I started reading literature about it, which really opened it up for me, because it gave me a sense of history, sense of geography,
context.
And context, and specifically living in New York the way I had, finding out that there was like this incredible culture of avant-garde jazz music, which led me into like avant-garde composer music, and this like the world of avant-garde New York City, and then like its relationship to Europe, the West Coast, San Francisco, and that really, the late 80s into the 90s just opened up this whole world of like whole new vistas for me as far as like music was concerned, that I really, really, really related to, that I just was like only sort of aware of beforehand, because I had been playing with people like Glenn Branca who were coming out of this lineage, but I wasn't really seeing that. I wasn't really aware of that lineage. I was taking it for granted that there was like this kind of music existed, but I didn't realize its historical context or, you know, its value. And so that, yeah, I just became completely immersed in investigating jazz music.
Your pop wrote?
My classical, sort of, traditional, more sort of traditional modern classical. Not even modern classical, just like, you know, coming out of Bach kind of music. But
you think he influenced you?
The fact that he was devoted to musical life, yeah. I mean, I used to close my ears to anything classical because, you know, I was Yeah, you'd be playing the radio, and I was like, come on, you know, put on the Guess Who, you know.
Well, we're going to play something by your brother here.
Yeah, I'm only putting out CDs. This is my label, Ecstatic Peace, that I've been doing. This bedroom label, vanity thing I do, non-competitive, and which means I don't really spend money on promoting it so much. But I do come to certain radio stations once in a while. I've been putting out stuff for years. I got there's over 100 Ecstatic Peace releases out there, I guess. If you can
find there's a Dose one.
But
there's a Minute Man one without George Hurley, before George Hurley.
Yeah, there's going to be a Mike Watt Trio one if he ever gets off his ass and does it.
Yeah, that's right. He wants me to do
double
Riot Girl stuff.
I want to do double 7-inch, 2 7-inches.
Television and...
Television.
Slater-Kinney.
And then Slater-Kinney Bikini Kill one.
Well, anyway, tell us about Gene. This
is right
your
now,
older brother,
the
Gene
focus
Moore.
Of the label right now is just putting out CDs and records by, like, my relatives, like my brother and his kids, because they're all like these kind of like weird basement geniuses doing noise music now, like coming out of a void in a way.
Wow.
And but yeah, it's weird. My stuff is like Oingo Boingo compared to what my brother and his kids are doing.
What about Coco? You think
although this track you're good. Coco?
You think she's going to develop into a thing?
I don't know what she's going to do.
She's seven now, right?
She likes music.
She plays piano.
It's kind of weird because
piano?
She's playing piano, you know. But she's like, you know, like these little boy pop bands that she hears once in a while. But she's sort of hip to the other things. You know, I was playing that last Coltrane gig CD in the car the other night, and she said somebody's playing a saxophone. I said, you better believe somebody's playing. But
well,
that kind of
tell
thing.
Me we're going to play this song, Flowers.
Well, this song is kind of acoustic guitar piece, which is kind of mellow. It's not that indicative of the noise music that's on this CD, so maybe later we can play another one. But
did he play noise back when?
My brother is a really proficient guitar player.
Uh-huh. Did he influence you?
Well, in the sense that I used to sort of open up his guitar case and play his guitar while he was away, and I'd break a string and I'd put it back, and he'd come back and he would kick my ass for breaking the string.
So did he have a good one?
Then he started putting chains on it. And so I would get pincers out. I'd get pincers out. I'd spend about an hour undoing one of the chain links, and then I would take the guitar out, play it, break a string, put it back, and then I would like spend another hour getting that chain link back on.
You have a nice guitar.
And he'd come back. He'd unlock the thing. He was like, "How the fuck did this string break?" I was like, "You got chained. I didn't get in there." He couldn't figure it out. Every time he opened up, the string would be broken.
Because I know you guys played pawn shop things at first. Did he have one like that?
No, he had like nice Stratocaster.
Oh.
But when I first moved to New York, he actually bought me like a hot Stratocaster. It fell off the back of a truck or something that somebody told him about.
A
couple $100. And then he gave it to me. It was really cool of him. And I used to play it. But then somebody broke into my apartment and stole it.
Donate.
Yeah. And
so
then,
this is Flowers. This is a nice acoustic thing. Okay. G. Moore, Watt from Pedro Show.
I'm not going to play this track because this is a weird track where he's playing the guitar through like this thing. I don't know what it is, and it sounds like Sun Ra's keyboard. Kind of cool to listen to, but I don't think it's something that maybe we should play right now. Let's play the first track off of here, which is more of one of the noisier.
Is that Flowers?
No. The first one's called Pollock's Dream.
Pollock's Dream.
Yeah. After the painter.
Okay. What for Peter?
Preeminent action painter.
Thank you.
Pedro show.
That's right.
Thirst, tell us about that track we just heard there.
Well, let me tell you. That track you heard right there is
three.
Let me catch my breath, man.
How's Pedro looking out there?
All right.
You need to ride your bike more, dude.
No. I just went out in the back and
California air again. Too.
Went to the store.
I had to beat off because I read this interview with Richard Meltzer. He said like anybody who doesn't beat off at least 8 times a day is not a man. So
yeah,
I'm trying to
for that.
Keep up with that philosophy of towards life. That was a piece by a friend of mine named Barbara S. Somebody I've known since the 70s from New York. She was a filmmaker, experimental filmmaker, who came to New York after doing some work in London. She's an American girl. Came to New York in the 70s and started getting involved with doing music, as a lot of artists were doing, as we were talking about earlier, visual artists. And she started playing. She got involved with this guy, Glenn Branca, who came out of theater and sort of employing a lot of his ideas and concepts into musical ideas. And he started getting into sort of these extended composed guitar pieces with mass guitars and unorthodox tunings. And tunings that were sort of these new system tunings that created these kind of resultant harmonic overtones there was a whole extra, another musical world unto itself. And he was really into investigating this. And she was involved with him doing this as well. And then she also did her own musical projects and called, she did something called Y Pants, which is her and these two other women playing specifically toy instruments, toy pianos, toy ukuleles, and a toy drum kit, and making sort of experimental rock songs with toy instruments. They were called Y Pants, and they were kind of cool. And she played with, and she also published a magazine of artist writings called Just Another Asshole. And she actually did a compilation LP called Just Another Asshole, which is one of the first places, I think probably the first place that I ever have a recorded piece of music on, is on that compilation LP she did called Just Another Asshole.
Oh, your cherry track.
My dog was on that track. Anyway, yeah, my cherry track. MCT. And so she was really involved with that whole world of downtown New York no wave scene, and she was a recognized figure on it. She's always a very sort of benign figure, as opposed to a lot of the nihilistic kind of attitude a lot of these people sort of expressed.
You were telling me she channeled.
No, that's somebody else.
Oh, the next trip.
Yeah,
that's Margaret. Right?
Margaret DeWeiss.
Okay.
Anyway, so she was involved with that, and Barbara, after her musical band life sort of became a little more secondary to her life as a visual artist, and she really got involved with this kind of impressionistic photography, and she's become quite known in the art world as a recognized gallery artist, museum artist at this point. And I've always remained in contact with her, and she's also created this thing called Drum Corps, which sort of is a kind of communication with all these women playing music beneath the radar of the mainstream. And they all sort of play drums together. And so she's always had this sort of interesting kind of pro-feminist agenda, which I always found interesting. And she recently sent me the CD of music she did, because I haven't heard any music from her in so many years, and I was really curious to hear it. And it was, she got together with this feminist filmmaker, Peggy Awash, and they called it Radio Guitar. And basically, it's Peggy playing radio, shortwave radio, which it seems like, and Barbara playing electric guitar. And it's really interesting because it's almost like Barbara's guitar sounds more like a shortwave radio, and that shortwave radio sounds more like this electric guitar sound. And they created this great piece called Radio Guitar that's split up into 9 tracks. We heard the 3rd track of that. And I just released this. And, yeah.
Is there a Static Peace website?
This is Ecstatic Peace. There is not a real Ecstatic Peace website. I mean, there's a Sonic Youth website up now called sonicyouth.com that is sort of cooking, and you can go into Steve Shelley's link, which is smellslikerecords.com. Right. I think it's smellslikerecords.com, or it may be just smellslike.com. Not quite sure.
But there's a link from you.
There's a link there in the Sonic Youth site, and Steve has the Ecstatic Peace link in there. But it's not, it's pretty much related to Ecstatic Peace releases that Steve somewhat distributes. He didn't distribute this one. I'm becoming more sort of independent releasing this stuff. I always sort of relied, for a while I was relying on Steve to sort of help me manufacture and distribute through his label. Before that I was using Forced Exposure, which is Jimmy Johnson in Massachusetts. And using different people as well. I mean, I have a fellow up in Vancouver who's been...
Was it Byron involved?
Byron Coley was involved with Forced Exposure when it was a magazine.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And
great magazine too.
It was a very, very influential magazine about expanding the parameters of radical music to the so-called punk rock community. It would, you know, opening up a lot of people's eyes and ears to different musics that were all relative to, you know, that were again below the radar of the mainstream. And that was one of the most exciting things in the last 10 or 15 years, is this new generation recognizing, especially through the library of the internet, of us all communicating like that, of realizing that there was this wealth of a musical and artistic world that broke down all these barriers. We had punk rock, etc. So now you have, you know, punk rockers going to Derek Bailey gigs. That's kind of fantastic. I'm sorry, I'm out of breath. I ran across the street.
No, it's okay.
To beat off in the bathroom in the four times a day.
Much respect to Brother Matt's pad for using the bathroom. Better than the kitchen sink.
Oh, yeah, come on. Yeah,
we get special room set up.
Chamber?
Love Grotto Central.
Well, it is the Love Grotto. When you told me it was the Love Grotto, I got in my Volkswagen and whipped down here as soon as I could.
Okay. Then we had, of course, your brother Gene before that with Pollock's Dream.
That's the thing with
what's his record called? Twisted Wires? Twisting Wires.
Twisting Wires.
Static Pieces. Is this his first record?
Sure is. I've been begging.
Cherry record?
I mean, I would go to my brother. My brother's like a married man with two children in the suburbs of Connecticut. And I would go there, and he's like always played guitar. And I would go in his basement, and he would be doing these like completely amazing sort of noise music pieces. And I'm like, there's people out there who are doing this and putting records out, and this sounds to me better than, maybe I'm biased because you're my brother, but in a way this is more interesting because there's a certain purity here. You're coming out of a void. It's not like you're sort of,
insular.
Yeah, and so I really wanted to have him compile a bunch of these pieces together, and he did. It took him a while. I wanted to leave him at his own device. I didn't want to sort of force the situation. I said, you do your own cover. You put it together the way you want it.
No wine before it's done.
Exactly. And so this is what he did. He's going to do another one. He's really excited about doing another one. He's in his late 40s. And he's like probably always had this fantasy of living sort of a purely musical life. And he saw his little brother go do that. After high school, that's what I chose to do, and I did it. But he didn't go that route. He sort of like, he worked a 9-to-5 job, and he got married and had a wife and a kid and kids. But I always think he had this thing, like, oh, I wish I sort of did that. But yeah, at the same time, he's a realist. He knows that, like, well, that's just sort of, woulda, coulda, whatever. It's like he's
woulda,
like,
coulda,
you know, we're all sort of.
What's your mom think?
But I'm giving him, Oh, yeah, my mom's totally supportive of us doing this stuff. I mean, the fact that I do this, that we got together, because we used to fight when we were kids. We were just sort of like
siblings.
We would throw like screwdrivers at each other.
Thrill, huh?
Yeah, we would kick each other. He would kick my ass. But now we're like best friends, so it's like this great thing. And so I'm in the position now where I can actually give him a forum to do this. And to me, it's like I'm more happy doing this than just about anything. Giving my brother place to record experimental music, forget it.
Cool.
I'd rather do that than like it's to me that's
than the K-Rock Weenie Roast.
K-Rock Weenie Roast. It blows K-Rock Weenie Roast out the toilet, dude.
Okay, we're going.
I did one of those K-Rock Weenie Roasts. I tell you, they threw us off the stage. They didn't. We threw ourselves off the stage. They had a little revolving stage.
Yeah. I've done so.
And I told the guy who was doing the revolving stage, I said, look, I don't want to. We're going to play this song, but we're not going to end. He goes, well, no, you have 2 minutes and 30 seconds. I was like, yeah, well, this song is 10 minutes long. We were doing the Diamond C or something like that.
Oh, wow.
I said, this song's 10 minutes. We're not stopping. I said, this is what you do. When we start, the song's going to really, the meat of the song will end after a couple of minutes, and then we're going to go into this improvisatory noise music that we play. So let us do that, and then sort of wheel us off while we're doing it. So we play the song, and we come out, and the audience is like, yeah. As soon as they start hearing us play, they're just like, this, what's this? This ain't No Doubt, And,
Bush.
Yeah, ain't Bush. And so we're doing this thing. And then we go into the noise section, and we're just like wailing. We're just like hitting the guitars, and we're like, and you see these little K-Rock kids in the audience, just looking like, what the hell? And then they start rotating us off. And I read the L.A. Times the next day, and Sonic Youth was like,
got the hook.
We gave ourselves the hook. We told them to give us the hook. So we look bad no matter what.
We're gonna K-Rock. Play something from a lady named Margaret DeWeiss here. Can you tell
Margaret DeWeiss is along with Barbara S., Margaret DeWeiss in the 70s was part of the No Wave community, and she was a woman who was really interesting. She was part of this group called Theoretical Girls, along with Glenn Branca.
Yeah, we're going to play that 45.
Okay, and this other composer, Jeffrey Lone, and this drummer, Wharton Tears.
Wharton?
Yeah, who we remained in contact with for the years. We recorded a lot of our music at his
studio. He's got a band now.
Yeah, Wharton's still very active. Drummer. He also is married with child.
Right.
Anyway, Margaret was a really interesting part of that group, and she was part of Glenn Branca's larger ensemble. And when I used to tour with that ensemble through Europe, the first time I went to Europe was with that group. And Margaret was one of the women in that group, and she was this interesting sort of academic woman. And so, and then we. Oh. Yeah.
Is this yours?
Look how big that sleeve is.
I'll give you $100 for that right now.
So what about this?
I'll give you $100, right? I'll give you $100 for that Hun 7-inch.
Yeah, somebody was telling me that, you get an eBay.
Yeah.
And you'll put up big money for records.
Who, me?
Yeah.
Who's telling you that? I never go on the eBay.
Somebody was doing a spiel with me.
I never go on the eBay. Jim O'Rourke, the guy who plays with us. He's an eBay warrior. I don't have time to go on eBay and start doing that stuff.
Okay.
You kidding me?
Okay.
eBay?
Yeah, somebody was saying this just a couple days ago.
People know that I'm sort of record collector.
Urban legend.
Yeah.
You know what the
I sold all
record?
My records. I gave all my money to
Yeah, I was telling people that about the because I was there with you with Byron at that thing in New York City where they had
tables. Yeah.
And you were selling your Sun Ra's, Saturn Sun Ra's.
Yeah. I don't. Anyway, Margaret DeWeiss sent me the CD after not hearing about her from 10, 12 years. And it was this music that she was making with her mouth. And what she does is she goes down to Ecuador and goes into the rainforest and spends time with these shamans and learns this whole thing of communicating with the other worlds through vocal chanting, channeling this vibrations. So she comes back to USA and she does this thing. I know she did this thing once at one club where she gets in a sleeping bag and lies on stage with a mic over her, like Lemmy style, and starts channeling these sounds from this Ecuadorian shaman practice. So she made a CD of this stuff and she sent it to me, and it was like one of the most unnerving kind of weirdo things I had ever heard. And I said, this is perfect for my label, you know. That's the kind of thing I'll put on and people just look at me and go like, dude, you got to take that off.
Well, so. You know what? We're running out of time on the first hour here.
So
Live from Pedro Show. We're going to have to come back and we'll come back with Margaret's piece. It's one big piece.
Right? You're going to play the whole thing?
No, we're going to play an excerpt. And then we'll play Mr. Branca's Theoretical Girls. So people...
people get ready.
Kurt Mayfield? I got a Kurtdom 7-inch right there.
There you go, a little serendipity.
Yeah, isn't that trippy? Synchronicity. So people hang on. End of the first hour, Watt from Pedro Show. We'll be coming up at the top of the second hour with...
more New Wave.
Yeah, Margaret DeWeiss and some Theoretical Girls.
Is this Secretary Spread?
Whoa, bro. It's Watt from Pedro Show. December 26, 2001, the second hour. Now, what were you asking me?
I was asking you, if this Huns single that you had, it was Secretary Spread, but it's another one. It's Glad He's Dead.
Yeah, and Busy Kids. That's some old Austin punk. It's the first one.
Hold on to this. You should sleeve it, dude.
What's that mean?
It's getting chewed. Your sleeve is getting chewed.
You know, the favorite record I ever saw in your collection was something you got from Germany, a 45, and they had put it in the sleeve before it had cooled off.
So yeah.
You couldn't even play it.
You couldn't play it.
Okay, here's some Margaret DeWeiss with I.O. Watt from Pedro Show.
You got me. With the intolerable kid on the Nova Lark. We were on the knot after a rumble in the Crab Nebula involving this two-way time stop. When you come to the end of a biologic film, just run it back and start over. Nobody knows the difference, like nobody there before the film. So they start to run it back and the projector blew up and we land out of there on the blast. Hold up in those cool blue mountains on the Nod, a heavy blue mist drifting across the floor, and the liquid air in our spines, listening to a little hi-fi jump note, fixes you right to middle, and you nod out a thousand years. Yet sitting there in orange flesh robes, the blue mist drifting around us when we get the call. As soon as I set foot on Podunk Earth, I can smell it. That burnt metal reek of Nova. Already set off the charge, I said to I&I, immovable and irresistible. This is a burning planet. So intolerable I&I sniffs and says, yeah. When it happens fast. This is a rush job. You can feel it there under your feet, the whole structure buckling like a bulkhead about to blow. So the paper has a car there for us, and we are driving in from the airport, the kid at the wheel and his foot on the floor. Nearly ran down a herd of pedestrians, and they yell after us, what you want to do, kill somebody? And the kid sticks his head out and screams, it would be a pleasure. His eyes lit up like a blowtorch, and I can see he's really in form. So we start right to work making our headquarters in the land of the free where the call came from, and which is really free and wide open for any life form, the uglier the better. Well, they don't come any uglier than the intolerable kid and your reporter. He's a great guy, the kid, or at least he's big. But Jesus Christ, I hate him. Everyone does, that being his profession. When a planet is all primed to go up, they call in I&I to jump around from one faction to the other, agitating and insulting all the parties before and after the fact. You have to move fast on this job.
Watt from Pedro Show.
Yeah, here with William S. Burroughs.
Yeah, that was William S. Burroughs from...
Talk Magazine FlexiDisc. I got a little ring in my vocal cord. Ring.
Yeah, that
thing.
Was on the Nova Lark, something he did for... In the old days, they used to have records and magazines.
FlexiDisc.
Yeah, it'd be a piece of vinyl. Sometimes you'd have to put a nickel...
There was one manufacturer in Florida. They used to do Evatone. That was called. They were called Evatone.
And they did them.
They did them. They were the one people in the United States who used to do those. I guess they must. That place must still exist. I don't know if people do flexi discs anymore. You know, not too many households have turntables, so it's not really a big
lost.
Thing. It's kind of a lost thing.
Before that, we had Theoretical Girls with "You Got Me."
You
tell
got
me something about that.
We Sonic Youth actually did a cover of that. It's one of the few unreleased tracks of ours that nobody's ever heard.
Oh, you got to flow it.
I got to flow it to you because this would be a good place to play it on.
There's also you wanted me to download something, but I didn't have.
There's
that
a track on our site. There's a Sonic Youth track on our site that's sort of kind of a no-wave stomper.
And it's from the Stuff to Be, right?
Well, the Stuff to Be that we're recording now. You know,
that's going to be classic rock.
Yeah, it's classic rock, like, you know, Khakis classic, that kind of thing. No, it's...
Detective?
No, we got some...
Sheriff?
We got some new tunes that we're recording down at our studio down there on Murray Street. And amidst the ruins of Ground Zero. If you go to our site, there's a song that's not going to be on that album, though. It's a short little kind of crazy song that it's on sonicyouth.com. You can find it in there somewhere.
But you're making a new record.
We're making a new record, yes. We're tracking right now.
And it's going to be out when?
No, hopefully it'll come out in springtime.
What, you got a name?
We're thinking of calling it Murray Street.
Yeah, for the studio.
That's our.
The stud was abbreviated.
Studio's okay. We were supposed to start recording the weekend of the 11th of September. Of course, it kind of got delayed a little bit. But yeah, our studio is about 3 or 4 blocks north of World Trade Center.
Jim O'Rourke was conking there.
Remember Jim O'Rourke? Guy's been playing with us for last year. He's actually helped write this material, which has been really radical.
Power book?
Never had anybody. No. He's not doing power book. He's
okay.
Playing bass, playing a little guitar.
Yeah.
So that's been really nice. He's been sort of adding his flavor to our flavor, and it's been this unified thing that we've really been digging. And yeah, we're working on it. We got all the songs written. We have like a good sort of 7 or 8. Big jam songs that we're
into. What's the label called now? It's not Geffen, right?
Well, we're still signed to Geffen, and Geffen is sort of part of the whole...
Vivendi?
Yeah, actually, Vivendi. You know, it's there. I got a feeling it's kind of a drag for us because we were really hoping that we would be axed along with everybody else at the time, and we didn't. You know, they kept us, and they had this whole thing because we're some kind of prestigious thing for them. But, you know, we don't...
Some badge
buff. We don't spend their money. You know, we don't lose money for them. We don't make money for them. You know, we make a little coin for ourselves from twerking. But for being on that label, we're not... I mean, that label is pretty much overseen by, you know, these guys who are really into this kind of current rap reggae... hip hop trend or whatever, hard rock biscuit stuff, and so we're just this thing. You know, we'll put a record out and they'll throw it against the wall and watch it slip down.
Is this the last one, maybe?
I don't know. You know, I would like to sort of put it out ourselves because I think we could do.
You did some.
We do a record. They let us do records ourselves on our own label, SYR, Sonic Youth.
Do you remember you were being pretty prolific? You had three.
Yeah, we got some more stuff coming out.
Okay,
it's been a busy year.
They all had different language.
Yeah,
on the covers.
Yeah.
What was the concept behind?
Well, there was the concept was there was a series of records on French EMI that were sort of called Perspective Musicale, which is musical perspectives, obviously, and it was a series of avant-garde composer records. And when we were doing this this record last year called Goodbye 20th Century, which is our sort of tribute to 20th century composer music with Willie Winant, who's going to talk to you pretty soon, and Jim O'Rourke, and some of these composers such as Christian Wolff and Pauline Oliveros, and we did pieces by John Cage and etc.
What about the guy you took me to see, James Tenney?
James Tenney, we actually do a piece of James Tenney's. Willie Winant, who's going to talk to you, is actually a very close friend and confidant of James Tenney's.
Little Tokyo. That was a trippy piece.
Yeah, that was a great piece.
I mean, they're using traditional instruments, but they were tuned all weird, and they were playing them small.
Yep.
Intervals, you know?
Critical Band or something?
It was a world premiere.
It was a world premiere. I don't know if it was Critical Band. It might have been Critical Band. It was a few years back.
Wow.
I don't recall who the ensemble was.
But, it was the Ear Unit or something like that.
It might have been Ear Unit. But anyway, where was I? Oh, yeah, we sort of... those records were... The design was... There was these French EMI series of avant-garde classical records from like the early 70s, 69, 70, that all had that same kind of cover, with different kind of graphic on the front. So we copied that, and we were doing this series of records, and instead of just doing it French, the first one was French, which everybody thought, like, you know, that's pretty pretentious. And we said, well, wait till you see the next one. It was like, it was French, and then it was like, we did Esperanto. I think we want to do one in Braille next.
Yeah.
That'd be hip. Kim did a record with a quartet that she has of improvisers, Ikoe Mori from who was in DNA.
DNA, I got a DNA record with
Clay.
A little later,
DJ Olive and Jim O'Rourke, and they put one out.
Oh, right, the thing Kim does.
Yeah, and that was that came out, and that was Japanese language on the front. I don't know. I mean, I'd like to sort of, I'd like this record to come out and be all that it can be, but you know, you are sort of at the mercy of ignorance. You know, when it
Merch.
Comes to, right now, I mean, the contemporary situation with Merch labels, it's not really conducive to a band like us. So we're, but you know, we sort of were in there for the long run, and we knew that there was going to maybe be some weird changes in the industry as the time went by, and there certainly is. And it doesn't really the way the industry now is, it's just not really geared for.
But basically,
like
you're
this.
Doing the same thing. You're delivering finished master
delivering
tapes.
Delivering finished master
right.
tapes.
No
They're
suits
there.
In the studio.
But you know, their whole the job. On their end is to sort of campaign it and sell
right,
it,
right,
but it's
right.
like the way
Let
the industry now is like it's like well, you know, if the Weenie Roast MTV kid isn't responding to it, we're not interested, and that's pretty much what you're at the mercy of.
Yeah.
Whereas before, if you work it yourself, which we could do, which we're willing to do, but we don't really have the ability to do it because we're I got a phone call. Hold on. Hello, hello. Excuse me.
Houston?
Yes. Yes.
Is there?
Yes. Who's this?
This is Agent.
Who is it?
Agent. I'm calling from his house in Northampton.
Yes. Hi. This is Thurston. Hi. How are you? The alarm? Did you say the alarm went on? The alarm just went on? The alarm in the house? Oh.
It's a babysitter or something? Caretaker?
Somebody
it's West Hampton, Northampton or something.
Northampton, yeah, that's where Thurston lives. The Smith College house.
I'm sorry.
No, that's cool.
I got an emergency situation here. I'm sorry, man. Live on the air. I got an emergency here. Hold on. This is real life.
Margaret DeWise and I.O. I guess it's a good time to talk to Willie then.
Maybe. Willie, want to come up? We're going to present Willie Winant here.
Yeah, introduce him first.
Willie Winant. Hold on. I let me make this. I'm sorry. Willie, why don't you just come up and introduce yourself?
Okay. No, you can talk.
I can cock here.
Go ahead.
There's an alarm going
Willie
on
Winant.
In my house right now.
Oh, man.
Hi, Coco. Hey, is Mom there? Can I talk to her?
Yeah.
Hey, Kim.
Maybe we should play a song.
I'm live on the air with Mike, but I just got a phone call on my on the cell phone here, and it seems like our Dutchin is at our house, and he said the alarm is, like, blowing on. Yeah, and then I lost the signal. So if you can call our house, he's there. And he's like, what should I do? What should I do? That's what he should do, but I wasn't able to tell him I'm sort of live on the air with his telephone. Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Willie, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce Willie Winant. Willie Winant.
Yeah, what's the connection?
Well, the connection is Willie is somebody that Kim has known throughout her years. Through various mutual friends and musicians, et cetera, and they've always known each other. Why don't you can tell the story better than I can?
Well, I've known Kim since high school, and kind of remained friends and in contact all these years. And she was sort of one of the people that turned me on to improvised music. She would turn me on to Miles Davis and Pharoah Saunders. She had this record collection, so. It's like kind of through music and through school I got to know her and we stayed in contact all these years, and that's sort of the connection.
Wow. Yeah, we did a gig, right?
We did a gig at the gig, I think.
Yeah. And Pico kind of near
yeah.
Kim's parents.
Kind of like this yearly improv thing that Thurston would do with Nels. I think it started at the at Christmas time at the Alligator Lounge, but this time... when I showed up, the lounge was closed.
For the rat turds in the kitchen.
Right, so then it moved to this place called The Gig, and that was the first time, I think, that we hooked up.
Place with sofas.
Yeah. So that was cool. And I think that was the first time that I met you, and then that we played together. And so that's that.
Well, we got a track here.
We got a track, yeah. Secret Chiefs 3.
And what's it from?
It's a... a record I did with the guitar player from this band I play with called Mr. Bungle. And sort of like a side project thing that the guitar player does with this violinist from Seattle named Avon Kang, and then pretty much the rest of the guys from Mr. Bungle. And this one has sort of got a kind of Arabic, kind of Iranian type of vibe to it. He was like, and so there's a lot of Persian instruments on this thing, that we all play, and he's got some guest Persian musicians as well.
Oh, great.
And I've done, you know, this is like the second or third recording I've done with this group, and it's mostly instrumental music.
What's
it's all instrumental.
Called?
It's called Secret Chiefs 3.
Secret Chiefs, the
and
name of the tune?
And I don't know the name of the tune. It's just track 5. I mean, they're all, the tunes are all Arabic names, so I can't really pronounce
it. Yeah, I had that problem with the, there's that Rocky Erickson record with the dog, his head ripping open, the dog jumping out, and it's got alien letters.
Right.
So I don't even know how you pronounce the thing.
Right, so these are all like weird titles and stuff like that. And this is basically, the music is by the guitar player Trey Spruance. He kind of arranged it and kind of composed all the parts.
Okay, great. Thanks. For Pedro show, December 26th. We had some Secret Chiefs there with Siege Perilous. You did, Willie, you did a percussion?
Playing percussion and drums.
And come on closer, Thurs. Get on this mic. Get on that mic. Watch the thumbs.
Secret
and,
Chiefs.
Secret Chiefs, Siege Perilous. And before that, we had Christian Wolf.
Christian Wolf, yeah. Trio 3.
Yeah.
And that was a piece that Christian wrote for my trio. I have a violin percussion piano trio called the Abel Steinberg Weinert Trio. And that was like one of the movements from that piece that he wrote for us.
Great. And all recent stuff.
All recent stuff. The Christian Wolf record just came out on John Zorn's label, that Sodic label.
Oh, yeah. Great.
And it also has another piece on there called Burdocks, which is a piece that I put together with Christian, the composer, and Fred Frith playing guitar, and cellist from the Kronos String Quartet, and a bunch of people like that. And then the last
Kronos
thing we
do.
Yeah.
Burdocks is a really famous piece by Christian. It's been recorded by a few different ensembles. We recorded it on the Goodbye 20th Century session.
Right. We did it with Christian Wolf there, too.
But there's a famous piece from the early 70s or 69 or something?
1971. It was written actually for the Merce Cunningham Dance Group. Company. And it's one of these open-ended, it's a piece that they call sort of in the indeterminate style, and it was sort of open instrumentation, can be played by a lot of different kinds of instrumentation groups, and there's elements of improvisation within the piece.
But it allows the musician to employ what he knows best as a musician personally.
Right. Reinterpret it.
Well, yeah, in a way it's these guys were really interested in truly liberating the musician in a way, and
the composers,
and also sort of liberating the whole notion of the composer and the musician on being on different planes, and sort of equalizing the value of the composer with the musician, so that everybody had sort of a kind
of equal role, in a lot
equal
of ways.
Role, a democratic role in the making of this music, composer and musician alike, and it allows the musician to employ what he plays. If I play a telephone, or if I play a telephone book, I am a musician, and I can use that as my tool to play this piece, and it will be as valid as the trained violinist.
Right.
As long as you stick to the score, and the game plan, and it's all about that. And that's
so
sort
like
of
actors
that was one of the most radical things.
Something like that.
Yeah. It's one of the most radical things that these composers did in the face of the Academy.
Right.
It was to do
because
this
they were supposed to be servants, more tasks.
Yeah.
Right. Actually, a lot of for example, a lot of these Zorn game pieces that came later, like Cobra and pieces like that, were influenced by these right. kind of early experiments by people like Christian Wolff and
so in a way that they were Brown. They were punk rock before punk rock, and that's the sort that's one of the enlightenments, one of the discoveries that I really enjoyed.
When you run up against walls, I mean, they were calling John Coltrane anti-jazz, right?
Of course. It's okay if you like noise.
He was losing more and more listeners as he was doing more and more what he wanted to do.
Right.
Which seems kind of the reverse of the trend. People pander more and more as they go on, it seems, a lot. In popular music.
Exactly.
What about this new Mick Jagger thing?
I heard it's I heard
new Mick Jagger record?
I heard it's
yeah.
There's some pretty good
and
stuff.
And he rented young people who didn't even know who he was to show up at the gig.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he rented some people?
Yeah. Can you believe that?
Yeah.
They call it music. We played some Stones last night. I like that. That's fun. But that's strange how these tendencies in music, where people actually want to take it or try to take it somewhere, and these other cats are just looking for handouts. Pandering to cliche.
I think they get.
But you know what? I think that makes, in a way, a weird way, well, or maybe a natural way, maybe a more heavy environment for experiment. Because the manure is so heaped up, maybe you're going to grow something really good.
That's what happens in our culture. A lot of the interesting music just comes out of our out of our junk heaps.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like the phoenix rising out of the garbage.
Yeah.
I mean, you have people like Harry Parch and Lou Harrison and people in the 30s.
Guy from your town, Ives.
Charles Ives from Danbury, Connecticut.
But Harry Parch was interesting because he actually did create music out of a junkyard and the early percussion music of John
Cage. Those instruments he made.
And then if you look back at the early percussion music of John Cage and Lou Harrison from the late 30s, early 40s, was music that they created, serious sort of art music, but out of stuff that they found in junkyards, like automobile brake drums and truck coils and old clock coils out of old alarm clocks and tin can, coffee cans. They created all this great music out of stuff that we threw away.
Tom Waits going from his piano to his industrial grooves.
That's right.
I hear what you're saying, brother. You're Bogart in the mouthpiece. person. Okay, you like Sun Ra.
Yeah, I like Sun Ra.
Okay, we got.
I talked to Sun Ra a few times before he passed on. He was a very interesting. He was an interesting sort of language philosopher.
Sonny Blount.
Herman Sonny Blount.
Yeah. From Birmingham.
From Birmingham.
Did you see him before the stroke?
I had seen him a few times before he started.
Me and Pettibone saw him at Sweet Basil's, and we got in a conga line for Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Raymond got in the conga line.
Yeah. With me.
That's a video.
Behind Sun Ra, doing the Judy Garland thing. It was bizarre. It was very interesting. Here's some Sun Ra. Friendly Love.
Thank you.
Pedro show. Thurston Willie's got to say bye.
I gotta go. I gotta fly back to the East Coast where it's cold, frigid. And I love it. I love it. I love this warm weather too.
Do you like it?
I like California.
Yeah, that postcard you saw.
I married a California girl, so yeah. You know, at some point maybe
and
we'll
relocate. You
brought
her to the snow.
I didn't bring her out there. She went out there looking looking for some no wave.
She you gave me a picture yesterday. Of Coco with the giant snowman.
That's right. Yeah, we had some heavy snow action out there.
And then
we also got global warming kind of melted it down.
Jay told me he used to ski all the time, and because of the ozone hole, West Mass is not the same.
Not the same.
Not the same.
Well, skiing out where we are is kind of hardcore. I think people don't really look at it. I'm not a skier, so I don't think people look at it as great skiing. I think they look at, like, you know, Aspen, Colorado, and all that kind of stuff. That's good skiing.
The drier skiing. But he was just telling me how things have changed since he was a boy.
He's changed.
He's changed, too. He's in India right now. Loves Emma.
He's in India?
Yeah.
I see Jay. Jay lives in the town next to me.
What's he doing in India?
That's right, Amherst. This lady, Emma, he digs a lot, and she's got an ashram there, and he's on it right now. Second time he's been there.
So Thomas Pynchon wrote these liner notes to this last track I'm going to play.
Oh, wow.
There's a CD that came out in 1990. And it was a session that was set up by Forced Exposure magazine, Jimmy Johnson and Byron Coley, who was working there at the time. They wanted to pair me up with these two saxophone players, Don Dietrich and Jim Souter, who are in a trio called Barbada Magus, who are the most hardcore industrial just free jazz noise trio of all time. And the guitar player in that trio is Donald Miller. So they excised Donald Miller and they replaced him with me for a trio. And it's just called Jim Souter, Don Dietrich, Thurston Moore. And we did this one session called Barefoot in the Head.
Right, I'm going to play the track on the phrase, Bass Backwards.
You want me to tell you what Thomas Pynchon said?
Yeah.
You know Thomas Pynchon,
the writer? Yeah, he's one of my favorite writers.
One night, Johnson, Coley, and I were sitting in the backyard with a bucket of fresh sangria and a few bong loads of some very righteous boo. I brought out a box of my live Sonic Youth tapes, and we were arguing about Ronaldo's tongue vectors in the third quadrant of society as a whole. Folk City, New York City, 12182. When one of T. Moore's downstrokes caught our attention, we ran the tape back and listened to the passage a few times. The subtly monstrous and mindless gush with which T. Moore hit the E chord made it obvious that his playing was not coming out of a complete spiritual void. This was a real revelation. It meant that he was capable of actually unclenching his brain and loosing demons of soul creativity. Because we hate to see anyone lack-eyed to jive-ass pop structure, white man emotionalism, a plan was immediately spun for freeing T. Moore from the shackles of Peggy Lee-descended dog shit that were obviously choking off his true human force. Deciding which Hamid cudgels might best be wielded against these procedural chains was a lead pipe cinch. Who but Jim Souter and Don Dietrich? These two men are the freest, loudest, swinginest white motherfuckers to ever jaw cleave an industrial strength reed. Their work with Borbeta Magus has long been a raucous fountain of tonal explosion and aesthetic purity, as well as a black-gloved fist up the diz of all conservative musical architects. If anyone could blow the lock off T. Moore's creational emo safe, Jim and Don were it. The rest was a snap. I had my agent get in touch with all the parties. She explained the points of our proposal in no uncertain terms. The results are presented here. Two free men meet a slave. Everyone goes home barefoot. Right fucking on. Thomas Pynchon, Somerville, Massachusetts, January 1990. Here's the first track off that session. All Doors Look Alike. I love being here, Mike. I can't wait to come back and be with you guys, Brother Matt. This is a fantastic journey for us down here to San Pedro. I really appreciate it. And my love to all the people listening to the show. Peace to you. Keep the faith. Right on. And don't take no for an answer. Thank you.
Watt for Pedro show. Thanks very much, Thurston and Willie. Played there, Jim Sauter, Don Dietrich, Thurston Moore, Barefoot in the Head. Something from 1990, the tune on the phrase Ass Backwards. Thurston made a mistake. He said it was All Doors Look Alike. That's okay. Pilot error. You must be well used to it. I've been listening to Watt. Brother Matt, we're at the end of the second hour here.
Yeah, 45 seconds to go.
Okay. And when we come up with the third hour, Brother Matt's going to do a spin cycle. We're going to do a special tune dedicated for Thurston, and Brother Matt will go into spin cycle. And DJ Talia's threatening to come. She got back from Mexico last night, and so maybe she'll have be here to do her thing, too. It's kind of a trippy Watt from Pedro show, but
special edition.
Good way to end of the year.
Special Kwanzaa edition.
Yeah, Kwanzaa. Kwanzaized. There's a record that Thurst gave me about nautical safety. Maybe Brother Matt will mix it into his spin cycle there. So the deja vus will visit once again upon us. It's a Watt from Pedro show. December 26, 2001, the third hour. Soft Boys. Thurston was foaming about that song when he first got here, and not one of my favorites. I like the Can of Bees record, but that's for you, Thurst. Thanks to you and Willie for coming by. Now we're going to go to Brother Matt's spin cycle.
Right on.
Two steps, steps, steps. Come on. wearing velvet pants. He's got a nice body. He's wearing velvet pants.
Thank you. Christopher.
Brother Matt, another installment spin cycle had to be a little shortened because of the lengthy spiel from special guest Thirst. DJ Talia made it.
Welcome back.
Hello.
Over here on the thing, Talia. She's going to have a little spin session next, too. First, we're going to play something from Petra Hayden. Part of me and Talia's band, Lil Pit. And Bangin's going in the studio day after tomorrow, and we're going to do some Pit interpretations. Nels Perkins and myself and Willie. So here's some Petra, and then you'll be hearing DJ Talia. Watt from Pedro Show.
wish that I could hold you. Oh, do you know how many times I wish that I could mold you into someone who could cherish me as much as I cherish you.
Of turmoil trees to feed and become food for thought. Your plot and every team rides on streamlined wings, blind action tires react to broken gravel. Contact gives traction to travel. Unbelievable is what it is as you whiz recklessly close to colossal corners. Pink stickered organ donors, caution, curvas peligrosas to give treats to weary roads and women living not as a hope. You'll cope when you get there, but be aware of excruciating development in this crash course. For fists with fists, keep crisp contact to approaching vision. These are decaying and decomposing demigods devoted to devour and denote dexterity. Prevent prosperity, concealing themselves in serenity and sincerity. Offering you a view on a hill, bouncing boulders in your way, hoping that you stray away through adventures of honey and milk, the lost road of silk, the path that laughs last and still smirks. Come lurking about.
give no handout. In this myth exists always the existing that's twisted. I recommend you put your hands on the wheel. I listen on the road. No te preocupes en otra cosa. Passion takes too harsh for fear las curvas peligrosas. And continue, but they the thunder is sparing the rain. And all in vain, fresh you remain thundering. Fresh you of course, rugged and ragged. Would be more true to ride a horse without a name. On the passage, just moving domain. Mile for hour, needles remain stagnant. Excursion, your version of the truth is unclear. Here and see nothing but false probability. No insurance for liability. For given at any time, you may be found undermined by your own actions. Weak as your momentum moves, breaking an occasional fit, wrapping around curves with fits. No guardrails, no reflectors lit, and this canyon sits with eyes, waiting to drive by, splattered dry flies, and other bug parts streak the grill. Now asking if you had your bill, uphill, untranquil, luxury as this hex highway hits home, it's easy to be misled to think, you can't go further, backtrack, and recover, but don't bother, las curvas peligrosas crumble one and smutter, flawlessly falling, and isn't that appalling, but generated by external elements, like the waves are moved by soft winds and deep currents. Let your thoughts come and go freely. Don't cling to them. They're only fleeting and will change like the waves of the ocean. Through yoga, you learn to travel light, relaxed mentally and physically, without extraneous baggage to wear you down. Whenever negative thoughts come to your mind, slowly empty them like a gently moving current of water until only the good thoughts remain. Thus, you develop the power of constructive thinking. This will soon become your pattern of thinking and acting positively, giving you a new reserve of energy and a feeling of inner harmony. Now take a deep, long breath and stretch. Feel how completely relaxed you are. Whenever you are tired, tense, or nervous, listen to this relaxation guide. Play it over until the quietening influence has become part of you. Discover the joy of new energy, inner harmony, and the mastery of everyday living.
Tell me. the only ones who know how to be happy. How to be happy. 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 No, sir. I know someone else. A helicopter. Helicopter. That's right. Right. A happy helicopter.
I am a happy helicopter flying in the sky. So high, so high, so high up in the sky. I have a lot of little tricks I'd really love to try. Oh me, oh my, I'll try them while I fly. Brrr, that's the way my engine goes. Brrr, what a funny sound. Brrr, and as everybody knows, brrr, my blades go round and round. I am a happy helicopter flying in the sky. So high, so high, so high up in the sky. I have a lot of little tricks I'd really love to try. Oh me, oh my, I'll try them while I fly. Brrr, I go down and I go up. Brrr, I go anywhere. Brrr, I can start and I can stop. Brrr, away up in the air. I am a happy helicopter flying in the sky. So high, so high, so high up in the sky. I have a lot of little tricks that really help to fly. Oh me, oh my, I'll try them while I you
Colors of earth, rocks, and variety. Medical equal with helmets on the space people. Galactic and eight, the verdict can't demonstrate. You'd be confused and disobeying planet rules. Biochemistry with stars for publicity. Megasonic base with data chips in your face. Nuclear lindrums that bang hard on dark tracks. Reacting reverb, conscious spots on your nerve. I'll take a break like James Brown to the bridge. Feedback, magnetic orders, x-ray. You see skeletons flying off on the next day. We can pass the cover with the oxalate gases return.
Here's George Jackson.
Back with intriguing positive minerals. You enter the sensor, searching rating at random with no condom. The rubbers would reach the testicles and affect them. By animal means, I mean your spectrum. As I walk through the garden of orange tomatoes, I see blue flowers. Blue flowers. Blue flowers. Blue flowers. Yes. I lay myself down to sleep. Let my soldiers keep as I look at Rudolph. The red-nosed reindeer rise through the sky, smoking weed. The wicked witches of the east, total running down First Avenue, riding with a Cadillac leaning to the side, holding
You don't love me. gonna love me yet. Oh no, God, you don't love me. You don't love me yet. Oh no, God, you don't love me. You don't love me yet. Oh no, God, you don't love me. You don't love me yet. Oh no, because you don't love me. You don't love me yet.
Bay or anchor, whether they be trawling or netting. If two boats or more were involved in an accident, it is mandatory for them to stand by to render assistance if necessary. They must also furnish their name and home port if requested. Remember, the rules of the road are to prevent collision. Skipper, give way to starboard. There's another boat approaching from a dead ahead position. He should also give way to starboard, and you will pass port to port. Always indicate your moves as early as possible so the other skippers approaching you will know your intentions.
Bot from Pedro Show. Thank you. Here, let's put that in the background. Yeah. Oops, not Rocky.
Skipper, I'll drop your anchor for you right while you check out your motor.
There we go. Wow, that underneath a little bit. Wrapping up the December 26, 2001 edition. Thank you much, Brother Matt. Get on your
bonus
talk there.
Got the full setup with the new edition.
Big thanks to Thurston and Willie Wyatt for coming by earlier. DJ Talia with her session. Brother Matt with the spin cycle.
Show.
The only Robert Catherine came by here. I haven't seen you. Robert sold me a 10-speed, got me back pedaling after 22 years.
Their emergencies are,
you know, I got a car when I was 16. I thought I outgrew that. What a dumb fuck.
An unexpected motor breakdown.
More than anything. That's why I'm in better shape.
The need for help.
My 40s and I am my 30s.
Why you check the engine?
Next show, probably New Year's.
Yes, we're in there, looks like.
We'll probably start at 10:30 or something. So the big
a white smoke signal
gong on the Korean bell will be halfway through the gig.
Yeah.
And we'll have a full
pleasure point celebration.
Yeah, and a full featured spin cycle.
Cool.
We had to be a little short. Thurston wanted to get into that.
Special guest.
It was a trippy show with the lack of beats.
Yeah, he had the cool spiels, though.
Yeah,
just like whips into like automatic history. Yeah, he got the history down for this little chunk.
Interesting, you know, he's from this little town in Connecticut by New York City, but close enough where he could be right on the pulse of the trip.
Good, Skip.
Thanks much, Thurston.
Run up slowly on your anchor
there.
Line.
Yeah, we're there.
Call it in.
So that's the end of another Bot from Pedro Show.
Anchors aboard.
See you next time.
Sayonara.
Keep your powder dry. That this channel